okay, Generative Energy 103 with Georgi Dinkov. And I was just explaining to Georgi and the chat that the first 6 months of this year were very bad because I had two dogs and didn't get any sleep. And then Georgi was telling me how difficult it was to have children. Correct?
And a spouse and two jobs and customers who email it 24/7.
Yeah, dude, I don't know. I honestly, the guy that gave me those dogs, if I knew what the cost would be, like, I don't know if I would have taken them. It would have been, I mean, so again, this is from a dog person who's never had any, not a dog person that has no experience. It was really challenging. They would bark all night. It was absolutely crazy, but nobody needs shed a tear for me. Go ahead.
They're quite delicious. I'm here from some Korean friends, so
that's a bad,
shit ever hits the fan. Really, that's they have like some walking calories around.
That's
you.
A bad stereotype, Georgi. We all know that Koreans don't eat dogs.
No. Definitely not. I mean, I have a friend here who in DC who basically travels back to Korea specifically for that purpose.
Jesus Christ, I didn't know that. Okay, so how is Bulgaria?
I guess about the same. I mean, it's just now like, everybody's on edge there, I think, as I said last time, because the war is hitting too close to home. You know, if anything grows, if the war expands in any way, it will probably be Romania and Bulgaria and Poland that will be like thrown in next. So the periphery of NATO, basically. And since we're just, you know, cannon fodder, several NATO higher ranking members have already said this off the record. Everybody in Bulgaria kind of, you know, knows that and expects it. So they're, you know, afraid that this thing has no solution, as you and I have talked many times. And when the escalation comes, and I think everybody, at least in Eastern Europe, thinks escalation will come. You know, these smaller peripheral countries will be, you know, the first to be thrown under the bus.
Like
same with the Baltic countries too.
Like, people are feeling it in what way, or they're just getting nervous that this thing is not over yet?
Oh, I mean, it's basically Bulgaria. So Bulgaria officially, the population of Bulgaria is anti-war. They don't want to go to war with Russia. But behind the scenes, the government, being very, very pro-NATO, and actually handpicked by foreign embassies. There was this scandal recently. I don't even know why it was considered a scandal. Well, basically, like, turned out that the elections in Bulgaria are completely fake. I think a lot of people realize the same thing is here, right? But it's just not as obvious. So in Bulgaria, basically, they had the prime minister go on the record, and I think he knew that he was being recorded, saying that there's no head of an intelligence agency in Bulgaria or any kind of a law enforcement agency or government official in general that does not get pre-approved by, you know, XYZ embassies. And those XYZ embassies were the US embassy, the UK embassy, and the German embassy. And basically, like, he kind of said on record, it's like, I don't even know why you bother voting. It just doesn't matter. We will put there whoever the powers that be want us to put there, and your vote doesn't matter. You know, it's completely pointless.
Well, the good news is Gavin Newsom is not running for president, so he says. Did you see that article?
Yeah, I saw that, but, you know, I'm not sure if this is good news or bad news. Can you imagine Kamala Harris getting elected?
I would
probably pack up and go like that very minute.
I would love if that happened. That would just accelerate us towards Judgment Day.
Exactly. Some kind of a resolution, right?
Yeah. Well, you sent me these articles, so and we're getting right back into the black pill. But WW3,
doom porn, yeah, as they call it on Zero Hedge.
Well, WW3 has already begun. Ukraine's security chief, you sent this to me. So I guess there's a common, that's what you would say, right? That it's already begun.
Did you see the incident today? A Polish helicopter basically violated Belarus's airspace several times.
No, I didn't see it.
And then there was this drone, Russian drone, that basically they hit a target in Ukraine, and then some debris apparently landed in Romania. So first, Romania is a NATO member. Obviously, if something like that happens, it will be a grounds for activating Article 5. Mm-hmm. So Romania initially denied this. And then basically, I think it's funny. I think their politicians are also picked by specific embassies, because the president, after saying categorically that this is not actually even a drone, they don't know what this debris is from, Within 24 hours, he changed his story completely, went on TV and said, yes, definitely Russian, definitely a drone. And then, you know, I think now they're starting to slowly, you know, backtrack from that story. Bottom line is basically these are, you know, obvious attempts at escalation. And, you know, forget what Ukraine's security chief is saying. It's just incidents like this that will probably lead to the actual, you know, some kind of a false flag or an event that will be used as a official reason to get into to activate Article 5. And by the way, they don't even need that. Remember the Gulf of Tonkin incident? Mm-hmm. It was completely fake. Mm-hmm. So, and that was what, 50 years ago? What's to prevent them from doing something like that? You know, these days, it, with technology being much more advanced, it would be much easier for them to fake an event like that.
Yeah, something
they may even be able to create a hologram and like make it really realistic and broadcast it all over the internet, and everybody will think, you know, hey, that's the real deal.
I also want that to happen. So speaking of something you can't fake, the situation we all find ourselves in with finances getting tighter. Well, yep. So, I mean, wasn't Ray completely right in 2020? He basically predicted all of this stuff that was going to happen. So we're 3 years in, the war seems to be intensifying. You called that like maybe, what was it, 2021 or 2022? Markets seem down. Like, what are your thoughts on that?
I mean, whatever you see the market going up is complete speculation. It's still the printed money that's in the economy. That money has not been taken out of the economy. Contrary to what people think, inflation is not increasing prices. Inflation is the expansion of the money supply. And by that measure, which is the classic measure, we've basically had doubling, tripling the money supply. So that's really, that's your inflation. How long it will take to trickle down and manifest into prices, it really depends on things like interest rate or maybe if there's a war abroad and things like that. So that's probably what's kind of like holding the inflation back so far. But this money has nowhere to go. And now with BRICS officially announcing their currency, they're for internal transactions and dumping the dollar, these dollars have to go somewhere. So either the war has to expand. It's really very practical, even though it's completely psychopathic. Basically, in order for the empire to survive financially, this avalanche of fake money has to go somewhere. And the only place where it can go, where basically, you know, it will prevent a hyperinflation from occurring, actually, really two channels. One, cryptocurrency. And I think Bitcoin is a bit of a, you know, all the other cryptocurrencies are a bit of a channel for that, you know, relieving the kind of like a pressure valve on hyperinflation. And the second is war, but the second being really more important. So once the war in Ukraine turns out to be, you know, unsalvageable in the way that the West wants it to be, I think we're going to either see some kind of an attack on Iran or, you know, God forbid, Taiwan. And you know, any of these, in Ukraine including, can, you know, very quickly turn into a, you know, a hot global nuclear war.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So as far as the finances are, I mean, like, I don't know if you saw the article, and it was on Bloomberg, which said that everybody thinks the market is having a rally. Actually, the market is down significant for the year, except for like two or three stocks that have to do with AI.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really a classic example of hype. And now I think they caught that the NVIDIA stock, which was kind of like leading this entire rally, there are some suspicious transactions related to who exactly is buying that stock and kind of causing this fake rally. So it may turn out to be the plunge protection team again. Basically, they're creating a fake rally by, you know, buying up the stock. There's no healthy economic activity. Another piece of news that came out, I think 2 days ago, DC was ranked as the least desirable city to move in or to live over the last 2 or 3 years. Just type it in Google. Type DC ranked least desirable to live. And that's a big downfall. It used to, just 5 years ago, just before the pandemic, it was ranked like top one or two as the most desirable place to go to. So no matter what you've been told on the TV, how robust the economy is, everything is fine, you know. And if DC is becoming the least desirable place to be, what does that tell you about the country and the economy in general? Yeah, things are most certainly not going well.
I think I was reading I think that was posted on Zero Hedge, and somebody was saying that they were like a trucker or something, and they wouldn't even go into DC or something because they said they'd get mugged or something. And the same with San Francisco, and then same with one other place that I can't, maybe Baltimore or something. So yeah. Tucker is a little zogged out, but Tucker warns of Trump assassination, hot war with Russia. Like, what if you, according to your fan fiction, what do you think would happen? I mean, is it unreasonable to say that 2024 is a likely year that some crazy shit will happen?
Not likely. I mean, there's no way out. I mean, that's what I keep telling people. It's like I keep asking people, give me a scenario that ends the Ukraine war or just gets everything back to normal without this escalating into a war. You can't. Neither side can lose this war. Neither side. If Russia loses this war, obviously Russia will fall apart. They've already said that if they feel threatened, they will use nuclear weapons, right? So the moment they use nuclear weapons, even if only on the Ukraine territory, they will be considered grounds for basically, you know, activating the entire NATO and you know, attacking Russia full on. The West cannot lose this war. I think we know this, you know, very well. NATO will collapse and probably most of the Western countries. So one possible solution is Ukraine loses, basically the West kind of loses the war, but descends into full-on fascism, very hardcore, not very different from what we have right now, but basically all pretense of democracy will disappear. You know, brutal censorship, jailing of political opponents, probably assassination, kind of like what happened in Latin America in the 70s and 80s under the military juntas. And then basically for, you know, most normies, quote unquote, they won't know what actually happened. But I don't think even that will continue for too long, because simply the West cannot survive without the rest of the world, simply because the West doesn't produce anything anymore. And even if it descends into full-on dictatorship, it'll still be dependent on outside world. If the outside world doesn't want to trade with the West or do business with the West, then the West is doomed anyways. So basically the West cannot lose this war. And the only thing that I think the West can do is, you know, the only substitute they can have is if they replace the Ukraine war with another war, more global or like, you know, potentially more remote in China. But China is a nuclear power. And you start attacking Taiwan or, you know, a nuke or two land on China, I don't think China is going to hold back and, you know, from like, I don't know, incinerating the western coast of the United States. And the nukes have long enough range to actually reach any city in the United States. So it doesn't really matter. And with China and Russia now allied militarily, you're basically looking at not taking on a single nuclear super nuclear power, but two of them. So really, I just don't see what the solution out of this can be. Economically, the West is done. It's finished. AI is a complete, I don't want to say disaster, but it's laughable. Sure, it will replace a lot of jobs, but only because these jobs were useless to start with. It's not really something that will generate, you know, something that will give the West some kind of competitive advantage, and they'll, you know, jump leaps and bounds above and beyond what China has. Did you see the news about the chip? Basically, after the U.S. imposed the sanctions on Huawei and all the Chinese companies from using some of the latest chip technology, China apparently, in a matter of, they probably had it under development anyways, but within a few days, they made this announcement, and now the latest Huawei phone has a chip that basically rivals the latest one in the iPhone, completely home developed. And the response from the West was, well, you violated the sanctions. What sanctions? One Chinese company sold technology to another Chinese company. What sanctions are you talking about? Well, that's unfair. That's unfair competition. Well, tough titties. That's how the game is played. So all of these sanctions, once again, as we've seen in Ukraine, are having the exact opposite effect. And basically now, China has been, by being forced into the corner, China now has completely homegrown technology sector, which rivals at the chip level, the Western one. And that was probably the one remaining discriminator that the West had that was still kind of like, being more advanced than China. So I don't know. I just don't see what the West can do economically. It has nothing left industrially. All it has is big tech. But as we know, big tech, actually, if you look at big tech's budget, like a good chunk of it actually comes from government contracts. Mm-hmm. So ultimately, we're on our way to full-on fascism, the merging of big tech with government, which is more or less already happening, has happened functionally, just not structurally yet, or at least officially. And, you know, once the economy is down the drain and nobody's really employed in a productive activity, I don't see what else the West can do except the two options. First, brutal crackdown at home on any dissent, because you know they don't want the whole system to collapse, and maybe CBDCs will be tried at that point. And two, war abroad, because even with the, you know, with a crackdown at home, first you're risking civil war, and you know I think even the elite doesn't want that yet. It's because they can get burned in that too. Even with the brutal fascism and crackdown, you can't hide the fact that the West is economically finished. So the only way to conceal that is basically by launching a major war somewhere. And then you can blame everything on the war. Either that or, I don't know, it would be stupid to try the virus thing again, but I wouldn't put anything beyond them. So maybe that's option number three.
Well, that was Putin's inflation, remember? They were trying to blame
that. Yeah, Putin's price tag, yeah. Price hike or whatever. Yeah, Putin's inflation.
But
yeah.
You know what? All you have to do is actually put on the Apple Vision Pro and you'll just forget about all this.
I know. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, or the Facebook, what is it? The Oculus or whatever thing
Oculus
is called.
Oculus Rift, I think.
Did you see the commercial? It was so sad. Like a dad having this thing on and is surrounded by his children. And he wouldn't even take this off to greet the children. He'll just look at them through this ridiculous thing attached to his head. And I'm thinking, man, if that's the future, yeah. You don't even need to advertise it because it's like nobody will voluntarily do that. But then I start thinking, a long time on the forum, I think it was circa 2015. I forgot what it was, but it was something so utterly stupid that came out of the FDA that I thought the medical profession is done. The only way these people can continue making money is if they somehow mandate the consumption of medical services and products. And that's exactly what we had in this attempt in 2020.
Well, I want to get to the stupidity of the medical profession, and you had a close interaction with somebody.
Okay.
We'll get to that later. I do want to ask you if in DC, are you seeing people in masks? Like, it does seem like this is some.
Oh, yeah. Everywhere. It's not as much as, you know, obviously during the pandemic, but there are people out there, but, you know, and they're, you know, especially in the stores.
But like they're wearing
a few of them basically accosted me over me not wearing a mask.
Oh, wow. Recently?
No, I mean, other people are not wearing masks too, but I think I attract like a special kind of attention basically because like I don't particularly like people like that with the masks running around. So I probably give them a bad look and then they give me a bad look back and then we have an exchange.
That happened to me too. But I was asking, since kind of they've been stoking the flame here of this new variants, because I went to Costco and probably, I don't know, the last few months I've seen no masks, and we just went maybe 2 days ago and there were lots of masks. And
so, same increase. Definitely increase in masks. I would say somewhere in between, you know, I would say late last year when almost nobody was wearing a mask, mm-hmm. and the peak of the pandemic being, you know, the people with the most masks. Now we're kind of, you know, halfway in between.
Yeah, this guy kind of got us into this mess. And so it's
cool.
Trump. I mean, he kind of like allowed it to happen on his watch.
Yeah, I think, you know, he's I mean, I guess like he thought that as a president, he can have other people run the country. He'll just sit there and can give speeches. But you know, Fauci and all the others that were around him, the deep state snakes, that's all they needed in order to mess things up. I don't know.
And then
I don't want to completely rob people of hope, but you know, if Trump comes, if Trump is tomorrow elected, what can he possibly do to change things overnight? I think the one thing that he can and probably will do that will be great is prevent complete annihilation of humanity by avoiding nuclear war. And that's huge, obviously. You know, nobody wants to die.
He could sip the toxic waste out of the Ohio River.
But as far as the economic situation, which I think is the underlying reason we are in this mess to start with, I don't see what Trump can do. I mean, there have been some attempts at reshoring, as they call it. Intel is building a big plant for chips in Arizona. And I think the TSMC, the Taiwanese company, is now building another plant, I think also in Arizona. But the problem is these are attempts at reshoring some of the, you know, some of the high tech production in the United States. The problem is with the salaries of the United States, whatever you produce in these plants is not going to be price competitive. So I think that's why we're seeing a lot of this migration coming in through the border, because migration has always been, as we know, is basically slave labor. And people that will be willing to work for, you know, very small, small wages, provided that they're giving, I don't know, access to citizenship and like free medical care and whatnot, whatever the government does. But even if the government pays for it, this money has to come from somewhere. And now we're at the end of the ability to print more money, lest we run into a hyperinflation situation. If we run into a hyperinflation situation, then again, in like the West is economically done. And usually in a situation like that, wars break out. There was actually Marx, in my opinion, greatest prediction. He said there's this thing called the tendency of the marginal profit rate to decline. So he said that basically the competition and the prices do not go down because of competition, but actually the going down of prices is what causes the competition and ultimately wars, either domestic or international. So we're kind of seeing that here. Basically, the profitability is so low at this point in the Western world, and everything that could have possibly been outsourced has already been outsourced. That, you know, there's little that the West can do in terms of economic activity that can support its own population. So from a very pragmatic, though psychopathic point of view, yes, the governments basically took a look at their aging population, the majority of which is non-productive or at least not employed in productive activity, and said, we can't support you people. Sorry, plebs. You know, we're going to kill you. I know a lot of people don't want to hear that, but what do you do as a government, as a you know, deep state employee? There's no ethics here. There's no morale. It's just pure pragmatics, pure numbers. They're saying we like to keep this country the way it is, but with the current budget and the current finances, because we gave all the money to the elite, there is not enough for the plebs. So, plebs, you either accept drastically reduced standards of living, and or they're not mutually exclusive. A good portion of you get killed.
Well, yeah, if you were trying to transition people into a new system that they had to be fooled into enjoying, you know, you'd probably just want to get rid of a significant amount of them to not have to deal with it, you know?
I just don't think they care anymore whether we enjoy it or not. They're feeling that combination of desperation plus confidence that you know, no matter what they shove down our throats, 2/3 of the people would say, yes, give me more.
Mm-hmm. So, and then these banks buying up tons of gold is just their
move. That's another sign. I mean, basically, like don't read what the politicians are saying. Look at what the banks are doing. The Bank of China, I think a lot of the Western European central banks, a lot of them are buying up gold. I don't know if the Federal Reserve is buying gold, but I don't know. They claim they have a ton of in Fort Knox, but every time Ron Paul wanted to do an audit of the Fed or an audit of Fort Knox, he got shot down by his colleagues, both Republicans and Democrats, mm-hmm. which really shows you this, the Uniparty. There's only one party there. He never got around to, you know, getting this moving, even though, remember, the Fed has never been audited. Nobody knows what's on the balance sheet of the Fed, where the money is coming from, where is it going? Is the Fed monetizing the debt, which is illegal, by the way, under the U.S. Constitution? Nobody knows because there's no audit. So you have an organization that is the only commitment that they have to the U.S. government is that I think the Fed chair is appointed by the president, but he has to be voted in, or she has to be voted in, by the 12 regional Fed banks, right? The chairs of the Fed banks. So it's this organization that is not subject to any audit or control. They can do whatever they want. And by the way, they're owned, obviously, because the regional banks are owned by private banks. So for example, the New York Fed, it's the five largest shareholders of that Fed are Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Citigroup, and I think used to be Lehman Brothers, but Lehman Brothers is no longer there. So when the New York Fed decides to print money and give it to the private banks, there is no control over it. And basically the question is like, so how does the New York Fed decide that it needs to print money? Well, shareholders still, it's stupid. They say, hey, we're dying, we need more money. So this organization is supposed to regulate you, but you're owning it because you're a shareholder in the organization, decides to print money and give you money basically completely unaccountable and in fact secretly. I think there was that act, the Glass-Steagall Act, mm-hmm. or the one that got passed in 2010 after the great financial recession, whatever it's called. Mm-hmm. So basically, the Fed has to publish the banks that have been in distress and have taken money from the Fed, but the law says there's a 2-year delay. So basically, now we can get printouts, and they publish it in a very cryptic way, so you can't really decipher easily which banks are getting what and how bad their financial situation is. But there's this blog called Wall Street on Parade. If you go and check it out, they publish a lot of good stuff there. So now we're getting information that basically of what happened to the banks back in September of 2021, and if you look at the stuff that they've been publishing from October of 2019 to like mid 2020, basically all the Wall Street banks were insolvent again. And the only thing that saved them was the massive money printing, mostly by the New York Fed. And what spurred that decision? the shareholders, the bank's still underwater, said, give us more money. But it's really strange. This money's being printed out of thin air and given to the banks completely risk-free and interest-free. And when they have to pay it back, and they rolled over again at the zero rate. But that's not at the rate that you're getting loans, right? So that's how the banks make money. And really, there's no end to this charade. It's really a Ponzi scheme. There's no end to this. As long as people are kept into the dark, is how money is being created and what it's being used for. The Fed and its 12 regional banks are completely unaccountable to anybody in reality. Maybe on paper, but show me an audit of any of these banks, including the Federal Reserve itself, and then we can talk about it. That's the opinion of also the Wall Street on Parade people. And these are investment bankers who spend 40 years on Wall Street dealing precisely with shenanigans like this.
Got it. Generative Energy might have its first sponsor ever, but I'll save that for later. Okay, I'm going to skip these Google censorship articles. We can talk about those another time. I do want to talk about this. And so shout out to Joey for telling me about this. I didn't even know it happened, but I love this exchange.
Oh, with the nitric oxide doctor?
Yeah, Dr. Nitric. And so,
did you check him? Did you check that she has a company that pushes nitric oxide supplements
I'm not surprised.
Yeah. But why would be so gung-ho about nitric oxide unless he has something, he has some kind of skin in the game?
That's what happens. If I was Danny Cortisol, I think it would be a big problem. But anyway, so give me a breakdown here. You post nitric oxide causes autism blocking, no reverses autism. And the funny thing is,
somebody else engaged him, basically said, like, started providing information. I don't know why. Oh, he said there's a classic example of misrepresentation of data, right? Mm-hmm. But it's like, once again, it's not me saying these things. I'm actually quoting the study, and these are also doctors, right? So you may dislike Georgie all you want, but if Georgie is simply quoting a study which says nitric oxide causes autism, and actually they did block nitric oxide synthase, and then they reversed all the symptoms of autism, then there's very little room for argument here unless you can present data that shows the exact opposite, of course, which he didn't do.
This is so...
He says misrepresentation, and other people started jumping on him and saying, like, hey, how about this? How about that? and then he kept basically saying that the classic answer is either you're a layman, or I'm not even going to bother trying to explain such complicated and convoluted things to layman, right? Or misrepresentation. Those are the answers. Usually the doctors that don't want to see the evidence, the contrarian evidence, that's how they shut you down. So we kept exchanging, you know, these messages. And every single time I sent him something, like especially the nitroglycerin. So that's a classic example of nitric oxide being actually bad for the very thing that it's actually prescribed for. Nitroglycerin is one of the oldest drugs for angina. It's a nitrate, so it's a precursor to nitric oxide. And because of its vasodilation properties, it's been prescribed since the 1960s, if not even earlier, as a treatment for angina because it raises nitric oxide, it vasodilates, and then you get less chest pain. However, there's a study from Stanford which shows that if you take nitroglycerin chronically, you get much worse and actually deadlier heart attacks. So I said, do you care to explain why, you know, taking nitroglycerin would worsen cardiovascular outcome? And he said, nitroglycerin is not nitric oxide.
Thank you.
And I said, are you serious? Yeah, smart. Yeah, of course, awesome. It's not nitric oxide. So I said, are you serious that, you know, that's, it's one known mechanism of action is nitric oxide elevation. And then he says, no, it's not nitric oxide to blame. It's the conversion of nitroglycerin to nitric oxide that goes astray. And this causes resistance to nitric oxide somehow. And that's really why nitroglycerin is bad. And then I had other studies. I basically found out, he said, I think he concluded by saying, oh, you guys keep doing anti-nitric oxide stuff. I'll keep doing the nitric oxide stuff and let's see who lives longer. And then I immediately just typing in Google arginine lifespan, or like nitric oxide lifespan. I think you remember the study that I posted on the forum a long time ago. It was called the nitric oxide theory of aging.
Oh, yeah, by McCann.
Yeah. I kept posting all these things. He ignored me completely. And eventually somebody said on that thread, they took a picture of his head and said, like, judging by your foreline, I think we're going to outlive you or something.
Well, I highlighted it because of how typical it was. Like, you really nailed it. Like, with each one of his responses was very predictable. And this was the I can't remember where it was. Something like the greatest danger to knowledge is not ignorance, but rather an illusion of knowledge. Like that's how ironic.
And I think the response to that, for, if you click on this, I think there's somebody guy said, "Well, where'd you out yourself? It's the most ignorant example of his species or something along
this
those lines."
This might be a bot or something. This is so bad.
No, it's not a bot. If you, I mean, the account may be a bot, but this doctor, if you Google him, you'll see that he has a company peddling elevation of nitric oxide. I forgot it was if it was through supplements or inhalation or injections, but he has a nitric oxide boosting company.
Well, speaking of the actual initial article, how does nitric oxide cause autism and what?
Oh, yeah, I got some response about it too. They said, well, it's because it's vasodilation, and if you vasodilate too much, you can basically, what did they say? They can create like a shock type of situation in the brain, which is true. Mm-hmm. That's why methylene blue is used as an anti-shock treatment because it opposes nitric oxide. However, the mechanism of action that they found was actually that nitric oxide, even in slightly supraphysiological doses, was toxic, very, very toxic to the brain cells. Mm-hmm. Decrease the synthesis, basically decrease protein synthesis in the brain. So it really means that if you get brain cells dying, I know medicine doesn't want to admit that the brain cells can be renewed, but they can, unless you have something toxic like nitric oxide. And unfortunately, they didn't talk about its anti-metabolic effect. But if you look at the proteins whose synthesis nitric oxide inhibits, they all depend on cytochrome C oxidase. And we know that nitric oxide can bind with cytochrome C oxidase and can form a covalent bond, which means it deactivates it permanently unless you either knock it out of there or new cytochrome C oxidase is synthesized. The latter process being very slow. So what can knock it out of there? Methylene blue, magnesium, and zinc are three that are known to do it. So in other words, the study kind of confirmed that nitric oxide's anti-metabolic effects are very, very toxic to the brain. Which is not surprising, as we know that the brain is the most sensitive to energetic disturbances since it consumes about 40% of your calories. But it was a direct nitric oxide effect. It wasn't due to its vasodilation effects or any of the other ones that are being ascribed to it.
We're getting a little hiccups in the stream, but
For me?
I mean, no, you're fine. So I apologize, but we'll just have to go through it. And this is recorded, so we can always upload it later. But and in that McCann paper, which we've probably talked about dozens of times, he basically, there isn't any part of the stress system that nitric oxide does not intensify, from the production of prostaglandins to the activation of CRH, to the activation of ACTH, activation of the adrenals. Like, it just seems like... I don't know what research these people are reading, but you have to be really ignorant to how you have to be really focused on like health outcomes or like that kind of fraudulent type of scientific thinking and not think about how it's interacting in the body. I think it's,
but that's exactly what they do. Medicine is specialized, right? They're reductionists. So once they latch onto the idea that nitric oxide is vasodilatory, which it is, and then that any kind of ischemia problem is due to like insufficient vasodilation or blocked artery, right? Then they're saying, I don't care about anything else. If nitric oxide vasodilates and if constricted arteries are the problem, then this means nitric oxide solves the problem. The hell with all of you.
Yeah. So what would a more appropriate thing do you think would be like carbogen or CO2, something like that?
CO2, yeah. CO2 is, I mean, a nitric oxide is the emergency emergency vasodilator. If you don't have enough carbon dioxide, and two, it's the main first line defense against exogenous pathogens, even endogenous ones too. Any kind of a bacteria, virus, or fungi gets into your bloodstream, INOS immediately gets activated to basically produce nitric oxide, which is it's the reactive nitrogen species, which is much more toxic than the reactive oxygen species, and that's what the body synthesizes in order to kill these invading pathogens. But it's just as because since they're living things too, except for the virus, just as it's toxic to the fungi and the bacteria, it's also toxic to your normal cells as well.
Got it. Yeah, guys, I know it's hiccuping. We'll just have to push through it. I can't change the bitrate on the fly. Okay, we'll have to go to the next article here. Or do you want to talk about the brain making steroids? Because I actually thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, so the basically, for a long time, it's been known that the things like pregnenolone, progesterone, and in some cases estrogen, if you have a pathological, like a neurological condition, the concentrations of these are is much higher in the brain. And for a very long time, medicine said the only steroidogenic organs are the gonads and the skin. Anything else, like there's really no evidence for that. And they justified it by saying that by looking for the side chain cleavage enzyme in different organs, and they said it's not there. So you can have the production of all of these steroids locally unless you have the first step, which is necessary to convert cholesterol into pregnenolone. And then they said, so this means that basically this accumulation of all these steroids is occurring somewhere. I mean, the synthesis is occurring somewhere else. Then it's just getting transported to the brain. That's why they're accumulating there. So this study basically said, found that the first step in the brain only, specifically, the first step from pregnenolone to cholesterol, from cholesterol to pregnenolone, it's not done by the side chain cleavage enzyme. It's done by something called cytochrome 1B1, I think. Cytochrome P1B1 is the actual enzyme. Mm-hmm. And basically, that is the enzyme, I think, that is also involved in converting cholesterol into vitamin D. And one of the steps. So that's what converts cholesterol into pregnenolone. And from there on, they also demonstrated that the presence of at least two or three different enzymes that are down the steroid chain, which means that the in all likelihood, the brain can produce its own pregnenolone and progesterone, or its own androgens and its own glucocorticoids. And then as far as the estrogens, I think every race said several times, and I've seen quotes in other places, to saying that every cell in the body expresses aromatase, which means the brain is a complete steroidogenic organ, which conversely means that if there is some kind of a hypogonadism in the brain, let's say localized to the brain, you get the exact same synthesis you're getting systemically for hypogonadism, which means, you know, loss of the protective steroids and elevation of the emergency steroids such as cortisol and estrogen.
So you think the brain making pregnenolone, progesterone, DHEA, et cetera, is that mainly for like ordering water in the cells of the brain, like to stabilize cells, do you think?
Promote it's controlling the metabolic rate. Mm-hmm. Basically, the DHEA, the progesterone, they're in couplers. Mm-hmm. So basically, if the temperature of the brain falls, usually people experience like a shivering reaction. Mm-hmm. But if they measure, sometimes they measure the temperature and it's not elevated, yet mm-hmm. they still feel like the shiver, right? Mm-hmm. Which means that probably the brain, what it's doing is raising its own temperature by increasing the synthesis of these steroids, mm-hmm. because really it's the temperature of the brain that's crucial for keeping you conscious. Mm-hmm. I mean, you drop the temperature of the brain sufficiently and you're going into hibernation.
There's a book called The Hot Brain. And I leveraged it when I was writing an article, but it's pretty solid book. It's called The Hot Brain, Survival Temperature and the Human Body. And they're basically saying our evolutionary achievement was a hot brain. And so to negate that with jumping in a cold river or something for in the name of health is, it gets pretty funny, but yeah. Okay, so
I think that's also one of the explanations for why we are bipedal versus all the other animals that are walking on all fours.
Oh yeah,
it allows you easier control of the brain temperature. So basically, you dissipate, I think, less heat, mm-hmm. and then more can stay for the brain.
Oh wow, I didn't know that. So you're saying my dogs aren't that intelligent when they try to eat my chickens and things?
Well, if you put their heads into a pressure cooker and heat it up.
Oh no. Okay. Oh no. Is our stream stopped? This is not good.
Did it?
Cash is full. Okay. I guess we'll just have to.
Who's
keep.
Cash?
It's my ATEM unit. This is crazy. You know what I think it is? I think it's throttling from my ISP because it really doesn't make any sense. I'm really not using that much of the bandwidth.
The Federales are watching you, Danny. Probably. You thought you're going to escape the empire in Mexico. No, it's the backyard of the empire.
I don't know. I'll have to work on it. But we'll just keep going because we're recording locally. I apologize to the people watching the stream. Okay, well, why don't we do a little advertisement for ID Labs? So when you were in Bulgaria, I actually ordered quinone. And I should have emailed you, but I ordered two bottles. I probably would have ordered 10. But yeah, man, I use that stuff.
We had a limit because I was in Bulgaria and like, there was a limit of the inventory. So now we've lifted it. It's not 10 bottles, but I think you can do like 5 or something.
That's what I figured. So it was just a bad time to order. But I've been using that every night before bed. I put about 30 drops. So hopefully possibly the equivalent of 6 milligrams or so. And dude, I put it on and I get extremely tired. And with progesterone and DHEA.
I sleep like a baby with vitamin K.
Yeah, it's... it's one of the things that's become more indispensable, especially for my 6 months of hectic sleep.
Did you see the article? It's actually one of the things that I posted recently, that it lowers blood pressure in humans.
Oh yeah,
that must have been one of the topics that I kept getting. I've been getting emails for years about this, and I think even Ray got caught some heat because of that. But he said, like, there was no, even on the Peterian website, remember, there was this guy, Dewitt was the, yeah, the guy who was defending Ray, and there were a bunch of detractors saying, like, I have never seen any evidence about vitamin K ever lowering blood pressure, nor is there any known mechanism for which it can do that. And then Ray gave a couple of case studies, or like reports, saying that, you know, he knows a person of a person from firsthand, who took, like, I think the first time 200 milligrams or something, was a really hefty dose. His blood pressure immediately fell down. And then after that, basically normalized. I know there's a published case study of with MK7, not MK4, MK7, causing actually dangerous hypotension in this woman that took it. And then there's, of course, there's more recently been studies showing that vitamin K can decalcify the blood vessels, and that's, and it, which means it can allow them to expand at will much more easily, and the body can regulate the blood pressure more easily because of that. I think that's the main mechanism of action.
Got it. Yeah, I think Ray had mentioned on one of the interviews that, like, somebody was asking him about hypertension, and he said at the time the Thorn was, like, basically the only vitamin K product, mm-hmm. and he said to do a dropper for hypertension. But I mean, I don't need much convincing, because it's so obvious.
I can't count the number of emails that I've gotten that basically have used that statement of race as a evidence that he's a charlatan. They said, like, you know, he could have said taurine, or he could have said, I don't know, something, a vitamin E or something, vitamin D. But why did he say vitamin K? The one thing that has no evidence about this in regards to blood pressure, and there's no known mechanism. Mm. It turns out there is.
Doesn't it affect aldosterone? So, like, wouldn't the mechanism be pretty plausible?
That too.
I don't know.
But also, like any quinone, if it increases the oxidative phosphorylation and the synthesis of CO2 in the Krebs cycle, that by itself will basically be vasodilatory, and you're going to get essentially the nitric oxide effect, but from carbon dioxide. Mm-hmm. So that's another mechanism of action. Anything pro-metabolic is likely to, depending on basically how hypothyroid you are. Initially, if you're very hypothyroid, it may raise your blood pressure, but over time, as your health normalizes, then blood pressure should come down. It's not good to have chronically low blood pressure. That's usually a sign of a heart problem.
Got it. Okay.
A lot of people think that having like a 90 by 60 is really like a gift from heaven. They can drink all the caffeine and smoke all the cigarettes and do all these crazy things because, you know, they have so much room to raise the blood pressure too. But a vast majority of these people eventually find out that they have like a heart valve problem. Okay. Just the heart just can't pump hard enough in order to supply the periphery with blood. And in people like that, they usually have problems with peripheral neuropathy and sometimes even gangrene because they're in a state of like a semi-shock. Because the heart is weak, you cannot get the blood to the peripheral, really the distant tissues, and they're getting severe problems there and even necrosis.
Got it. I mean, I was trying to do an advertisement for ID Labs, and then you took it into useful information territory. You know,
how dare you, yeah. Georgian?
But Philip does say, can you ask about blood clotting with excess vitamin K? So doesn't vitamin K have pro and anti-clotting?
It does not cause excess blood clotting, but except potentially K1. I think there's some older studies showing that if you overdo K1, there may be an issue with clotting, but I think it was only in people that had a problem with their liver. So the, like, if you have a problem with your liver, chances are you'll be already prone to clotting. So in that case, and it was only K1, K2, MK4, and K2, MK7 are not known to basically cause hypercoagulation, even in very massive doses. There was a study when they were about to approve MK4, which is known as Glakay, GLAKAY in Japan. It's a prescription drug. So when they were running clinical trials to find out the optimal dosage, they also did a clinical trial for safety. So the dosage that they use now for osteoporosis in Japan is 45 milligrams daily. But they used up to three times that dosage, which is 135 milligrams daily, for up to a year. There were no side effects except mild GI disturbances, but zero effects on the blood system, on the coagulation system, and they looked very closely for that because they were afraid it's going to do something like that.
Yeah.
So I don't think you're going to become hypercoagulatory if you're taking extra vitamin K, except potentially K1, which I don't recommend people use that anyways. I think we're better to take MK7 to take K1.
And what are you working on right now? Any new products or any studies or anything?
Yeah, there is a product. I mean, they have the raw materials here. I just don't have enough time to release it yet. It turns out that on-chain saturated fatty acids are really, really beneficial, specifically the off-chain ones. The even chain are good too, but the off-chain fatty acids, especially the ones with 15 carbon chain length and 17, in other words, pentadecanoic acid and heptadecanoic acid, are really, really beneficial. And in fact, there's a company out from in San Diego that's selling the pentadecanoic acid, the 15 carbon one. If you go to Google and type fatty15, FATTY15.com, there's a company that sells that, just that fatty acid. And they've done a lot of research on the fact that this fatty acid is extremely prometabolic. Somehow repairs damaged mitochondria, basically raises your metabolic rate. It has a very strong anti-inflammatory effect. It has a very strong pro-cognitive effect. They've done sponsored a bunch of studies with it, but it's not all sponsored studies. They're actually basing their research. The reason for launch the company, they cite some older research showing that the pentadecanoic acid in general, the all-chain fatty acid, saturated fatty acids raise the levels of ATP in the body. And that's probably because of their effect on mitochondria. Now, the heptadecanoic acid, by the way, both of these fatty acids are found almost exclusively in dairy. Yet another reason to eat dairy. And in fact, the highest amounts are found in ice cream and cheese, which probably explains there was a recent thread on the forum showing that there's some kind of a magic or mystery to ice cream. And that's how the article was titled. Protects from diabetes, heart disease, cancer, and all these things. And they couldn't figure out what it was. I suspect that the presence of these two off-chain fatty acids there is the reason. So another name for the heptadecanoic acid, the 17 carbon chain one, is margaric acid. And margaric, I think, is a Greek word for butter. So that's where these fatty acids are coming from. So with margaric acid, they actually have a study with dolphins. I don't know why they did dolphins, where they show reversal, complete reversal of type 2 diabetes. If you open up a browser and type margaric acid diabetes, you'll see there's a very interesting article about dolphins with it. And really, like, relatively low doses because it's found in trace amounts in dairy, so you got to eat a ton of dairy to get them. But a product that when I get to release it, will probably have 100 milligrams of each. And that's the dosage of which at which they're selling that company, Fatty Acid 15. That's the dosage which they're selling the 15 carbon one. But my product will have both, the 15 and the 17 one, and probably dissolved in just olive oil or MCT, depending on what people prefer. And I'm still on the fence whether I should add the Corfol or not. Because I want people to be able to see the direct effect of the fatty acids. But if I add the Corfol, first of all, it's going to make the product last longer. And second, it will further improve the absorption of these fat acids through the lymphatic system, which is what we really want. So there may be some to Corfol, but the main active ingredient will be these two fatty acids.
Got it. Nice. Interesting. Cool, man. I don't understand how you keep creating these novel products.
You don't want to live in my head. It's a chaotic mess there.
Cool, brother. Okay. I do coaching on patreon.com/Danny Roddy. And it's since it's the beginning of September, I've opened up new spots. I'm also doing group coaching and I really had no clue how this was going to go, but it's so much fun. And if you don't need to talk to me for 45 minutes and you just want to, possibly bounce ideas off somebody and you think I could be valuable, then this might be good. And also the really cool thing about this is there's a lot of people from like similar places here, and then all sit back and then they'll bounce questions off each other, like, where do you get aspirin? Oh, it's like at this Boots or something like that. So it's really, and there's just zero shenanigans. You know, it's like 20 people all on the same page. No shenanigans. And it's, I don't know. It's been, I didn't know what to expect. And it's been really,
you know,
cool.
You've actually recreated how originally group therapy was supposed to work. Now it's descended into complete hell. And I don't think anybody should participate in group or single therapy for that matter. But I think that's how it originally was. It was very kind of like non-committal, non-official gathering where people simply were, you know, encouraged to feel human again. Didn't Ray say something about this? It's like he used to like the whole idea of like counseling, because but only the only if you can form a bond with the actual counselor. And then around like the middle to the late 70s, they started discouraging that and actually actively training the counselor not to care. Mm. And then he thought at that point it became that that's pathological. You just sit there with somebody who actually probably actively hates your guts or at the very least thinks of like how to get rid of you in the quickest possible manner with the least amount of time spent on you. But originally, that's how it was. Basically, you bond with a doctor and or the counselor, and that's therapeutic. In therapeutic for the doctor as well. Remember that study on the forum that I posted a couple years ago showing that the placebo effect is real, and it depends. It's based on dopamine and the feeling of rapport and bonding with the doctor or whoever is basically administering the drug. If there is no such thing, the placebo effect disappears.
Yeah, I think he would often reference Carl Rogers, and Carl Rogers, his like approach was less of a top-down approach of like, oh, well, you should do this, this and that. And
it was more important what person has the disease than what disease the person has, right?
Yeah. What type of person has the disease? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. What I didn't do my homework and I didn't check, like, which were the articles that were the most popular or that you,
I think the molecule dissolved in vitamin E, preferentially targets the brain. I mean, again, another great vindication for Ray, basically that they're doing some kind of a toxic oligonucleotides for healing the injuries of stroke. But then they discover by accident that if they bind these molecules that they think are beneficial for the brain, if they actually mix them with vitamin E, specifically alpha tocopherol, I have to do more research of why they didn't use some of the other isomers. But I think I know, because the transport protein for vitamin E is preferential for alpha tocopherol. It does not like the other isomers as much. I think that's why they're excreted in higher amounts when you take mixed tocopherols, simply because the body preferentially absorbs the alpha isomer, even if you take a mixture of the different isomers. In any event, they found out that if you mix whatever molecule you want with vitamin E and then basically administer it, it not only preferentially goes to the brain, but also preferentially goes to the site of injury. And I immediately thought of progesterone and pregnenolone being tried for traumatic brain injury, and Ray writing about, you know, all of their benefits for the brain, specifically for neurological disease, Alzheimer's disease, a stroke. I think he mentioned stroke a couple of times too. And if that's the case, then basically his decision to dissolve them in his original product, Progesterone, and I think he has a patent on testosterone and DHA as well. In other words, any steroid you dissolve in vitamin E, the study at least implies that if you take that orally or however, basically, if it gets into the bloodstream in one way or another, it will preferentially go to the brain and also preferentially affect sites of injury. So when you dissolve these things in vitamin E, you're able to achieve much stronger effect with much lower dosage, which is really the holy grail pharmacology, as I said in my post, is that basically specificity for effect and basically minimizing the dosage, which minimizes the risk of side effects. Apparently, vitamin E does that when it comes to the brain. So it's and vitamin itself is very therapeutic for the brain. So really a genius product there, Progesterone. 30 to 40 years before the study came up, Ray already knew that if you mix things with vitamin E, you're basically targeting the brain and specifically the aging parts of the brain.
Well, isn't that because it's picked up in the chylomicrons? Like the absorption is way better, right?
Yeah, but just because it gets picked up to the chylomicrons, then it travels and it gets released by something called the thoracic duct, which is behind your sternum, and gets released into the bloodstream. But once in your bloodstream, basically there's nothing that it's a mystery. Basically, there's no reason for it to go to the brain and also target the site of injury in the brain. Mm-hmm. Yet with vitamin E, it does. Right. So you see, when it releases the systemic circulation, it should go everywhere, right? And it does, but it somehow seems to preferentially go up the brain, even though that thoracic duct dumps it into the general circulation. It's not something that goes only into the brain.
Is that explainable? Is it some magnetic event or something? Or what do you think?
I mean, it's a very lipophilic molecule, and the brain has preference for those molecules. What I remember a study that I posted a couple of months ago, it was recent, showing that 3-beta-hydroxysteroids, specifically pregnenolone and cholesterol, basically have the highest accumulation inside of the cell. And they tested, I think, 20 different cell types, and the ones that were brain cells accumulated these molecules at the highest rate. So I think the brain, simply being like a 92% fat or whatever it was, it's a very lipophilic environment, and things that are basically lipophilic will end up going into the brain. That's kind of known indirectly from the, you know, studies with pesticides and other things that are, or like, or hormones or things that are given to the animals or to the plants, that if they're lipophilic, they're usually much more toxic to the brain than they're to the rest of the organs. They're going to damage the other organs too, but, you know, if you're using something on the plant or the animal and it stays in the animal and then you consume it, the more lipophilic it is, the more it's going to affect the brain.
Got it. That's really interesting. I didn't know that. Okay, let's go to, what else?
The vitamin D game changer for patients with GI cancers.
This is hard to believe because it's so toxic, but I'll entertain you. For
that's exactly what I thought. And of course, a handicap study. They, you know, they're really nefarious. I mean, medicine, I don't know what else to call it other than a direct fraud at this point. So they only use 2,000 units a day. And if you remember that study that was posted a couple years ago showed that the original calculations on which the RDA was based were erroneous, and thus the daily estimated needed dosages for most people were underestimated by a factor of at least 10. So when they say 400 units, which is the current RDA for an adult, they really mean 4,000, at the very least 4,000. Mm-hmm. And that's maintenance dosage. That's basically to keep you healthy. Mm-hmm. For somebody with cancer, I don't see why wouldn't they use an even higher dose. I know why, because the hospital protocols say vitamin D is toxic. It's rat poison. You shouldn't be giving it to anybody in dosages higher than 400 units. 2,000 units is a high dose. I kid you not. 2,000 units daily is considered a high dose vitamin D.
Yeah.
But there are actually published case studies. I think I sent one of them to you, of a person with end-stage pancreatic cancer, where basically she started taking 50,000 units daily, and the cancer completely stopped growing, and the metastasis disappeared. And she, to this day, she's alive and in full remission by doing nothing except taking vitamin D at 50,000 units daily. No hypercalcemia, even though people with cancer, advanced cancer, usually have, it's called hypercalcemia of cancer. That's because they produce, the tumors produce something called parathyroid hormone related peptide, PTHRP, mm-hmm. and it acts like parathyroid. So it starts leaching calcium from the bones. And it can, you know, eventually it can even cause death because of this hypercalcemia. So almost all people with advanced cancer have some level degree of hypocalcemia. So taking 50,000 units of vitamin D, if the medical people were correct, that should have killed this woman. Mm-hmm. It didn't. In fact, she's, again, I think 3 or 4 years later, she's still alive, still kicking. And, you know, I don't think she'll ever go voluntarily to see a doctor again.
Well for Ray was, oh, good.
So anyway, so this study basically looked at people with a number of different GI cancers. I think it was stomach, in other words, gastric, colon. There we go. I've highlighted them in red, I think. Colorectal, gastric, esophageal, and small bowel cancer. Yeah. So for all of these people, taking vitamin D at 2,000 units daily basically reduced the rate of relapse and death by more than 30%. I don't know of any drug that's currently approved or even development that has such blockbuster result. And I think that's why even though the study was done by doctors, it was deliberately handicapped, and we know that they hate vitamin D, even they couldn't hold back their enthusiasm, and they had to say that vitamin D is a game changer for GI cancers, because it is. Nothing else that's currently available or planned or in development is known to have such an effect. They reduce the death rate of cancer by in any stage. So which means some of these people are already terminal. So it reduces the rate. So another way to word this even more strongly is basically it reduces the death rate by 30% of even terminal patients. In other words, people who have been told you're 100% dead. Vitamin D says no, you're only 70% dead.
Well, in one of our last chats with Ray, he said that parathyroid hormone was it was the strongest promoter of lactic acid production. So, I mean, that would provide a plausible mechanism. If vitamin D was suppressing PTH, that would be like the cancer hormone, basically.
Yeah, and the other thing is because these people have hypercalcemia, as Ray wrote in one of his articles, the calcium paradox. Because the older people and people with cancer have elevated blood serum, they have elevated serum calcium, they're being told by doctors to completely avoid any calcium consumption. So if they actually, but in order to suppress the parathyroid, even PTHRP, you do need the calcium. So that's the calcium paradox. You already have too much calcium, but the way to get it down is to eat more calcium, right? So if the study only looked at taking vitamin D, if they had combined it with just a little bit, like 500 milligrams of calcium daily, I think we would have seen a much stronger result.
Yeah, I had a podcast with Ray, and I read this to him. It is extremely important to realize that calcium deposits in soft tissues become worse when the diet is low in calcium, and that applies for vitamin D as well. And I read that to him, and he's like, yeah, it's horrifying that nobody knows that in the medical world.
Well, actually, they do, but they call it the calcium paradox. So they're saying, like these people, we know these people are low on calcium because we tell them to eat low calcium. Mm-hmm. Their calcium is high in the blood and becomes, you know, large into their soft tissues, and we don't know how to get it up. Yeah. Well, one way is to eat more calcium. Another way is to take vitamin D, and probably the method for which we already have sufficient evidence is vitamin K. At the very least, we'll take it out of the soft tissues and dump it back into the bowl. But unless you restore the dietary intake of calcium to normal, neither vitamin D nor vitamin K will ultimately save you, because you just be cycling that calcium, and it's not a good situation. It needs to stay in the bone, and in order for it to stay in the bone and go into the bone when eaten, parathyroid hormone needs to be low, prolactin needs to be low, serotonin needs to be low, estrogen needs to be low. So again, we're going back to the metabolic rate and dietary calcium.
Stop me if I've brought this up to you before, but I feel like I brought this up to everybody except you, but I could be misremembering. But isn't it interesting that we don't know the full details, but with Ray's diet towards the end, like presumably restricting milk and cheese and things like that, if he's getting 50 or 20 grams per day. But the thing that I've been thinking about a lot is that he was probably in like a positive calcium balance because he was eating so much carbohydrate. He was eating so much fructose, and that was helping despite not getting much calcium. He was probably depleting phosphorus and maintaining like a positive ratio. And it's kind of interesting because you could try to do that through eating lots of milk and cheese, or you could try going to 600, 700, 800 grams of carbohydrate and basically doing the same thing, but decreasing those amino acids, eating a shitload of carbohydrate. And this is like
gaining a lot of the calcium. I think also because I think he said towards the end that last couple of months he was eating a lot of cooked vegetables. Mm-hmm. If they're of the green kind, they have a ton of calcium in them. Mm. So basically you are still getting calcium. It's just of a different type.
I apologize if I brought that up before. I just always think about it. But I wish I could talk to him about it more. Okay, we'll get just one or two articles here, then I'll let you go. I know it's really late there. Let's go to what else?
Pick? I don't know. I think the ones that I posted since we last talked were like the last 10, like the so 10 total.
Got it. What about stress injury, mitochondrial dysfunction?
Yes. Let me just look at this one.
Dedifferentiation, even cancer.
Oh, yes. So basically they demonstrated that if you block if you increase the production of reactive oxygen species, that's sufficient to actually get a cell to dedifferentiate. In other words, taking this to the extreme, produce sufficient amount of ROS, you're going to get cancer. And even mainstream medicine is kind of saying that. So that's why I think they're recommending, they're saying like, okay, if you don't have cancer, it's good to take antioxidants, even though you're actually in a reductive stress. It's good to take antioxidants because it's going to lower the risk of cancer. However, if you already have cancer, it's bad to take antioxidants because when we give you chemotherapy or radiation, they actually kill the tumor cells by creating reactive oxygen species, and the antioxidants will actually mop these up, and basically, you know, things will, you're going to decrease the effectiveness of our therapy. However, if chemotherapy and radiation work by creating even more ROS, that's exactly how you're going to get the entire body to become cancerous, because the study shows that any cell that they tried, fully differentiated, can go back into the stem cell state if you produce a sufficient amount of ROS. What else increases ROS? Oxidizing predominantly fats. What else does this? Lowering the metabolic rate, like low thyroid, or like high cortisol, or high estrogen. Any of these things that results in reverse electron flow. The myth here is that you're producing ROS when mitochondria is functioning properly. High metabolic rate equals high ROS. Yeah. Complete crap. In fact, even the Wikipedia page says that 0.5% only of the ROS are produced through forward electron flow. The vast majority, 99.5, even 99.7, I think was the other number that I saw, is produced when there is reverse electron flow. When does this happen? When there's a blockage at one or more of the electron transport chain complexes due to insufficient, like basically redox ratio of NAD to the NADH being shifted towards reduction, or FAD towards FADH shifted towards reduction. And the latter one you get when you're oxidizing too much fatty acids. The first one, actually, you're getting also lowered through the Rendel cycle. And even the Wikipedia page says that. So if you oxidize primarily fats, you will be basically stuck in reverse electron transport flow for at least portion of those electrons that are coming from food, which means a lot of ROS. And even the keto community actually is now saying, yes, we're producing a lot of ROS because we oxidize fat. However, that's a good thing because it's a hormetic effect. And basically it keeps us healthy and keeps the immune system going and whatnot. Not so much here. This study says that all that it takes for the de-differentiation of cells is to simply increase the ROS production up to a certain level. Conversely, if you decrease the excessive ROS, the cells miraculously differentiate back into the cell that it started with, which means there is no such thing as a cancer cell. There is no such thing as an evil mutation that turned the cancer cell into a cancer cell and you have to kill it. All you have to do is de-stress the cell. To quote Ray, he said, I don't know why people say they're cancer cells. All cells can only do what the environment allows them to do. And in this case, it's the ROS that's basically, among other factors, I'm not saying it's the only factor, but the reactive oxygen species are a major factor in dead differentiation. Limiting them is a major factor in red differentiation. And basically, because ROS are associated with low metabolic rate or eating a bunch of different, or being exposed to metabolic inhibitors, it kind of validates Otto Warburg's initial statement that anything that interferes with the usage of oxygen will ultimately lead to disease, and he thought specifically cancer. But I think to any disease, as we now know, they're all metabolic.
Wait, I thought Otto Warburg said that sugar causes cancer.
No, he didn't.
Oh, I thought that was...
No, he didn't. That's how it's being quoted, but he never said that.
Yeah, but you're saying that, so protein, carbohydrate, and fat are reduced down to electrons. They're passed through the cell. The NAD to NADH ratio is reflective of how many electrons are being passed to oxygen. And then when oxygen is not around, for example, for something like low carbon dioxide, you experience free radical damage or reactive oxygen species. And then those are a signal to the cell to de-differentiate and revert back to cellular division.
Yeah, to cellular division and growth and division and growth, because if the energy that's produced is insufficient for the differentiation, it becoming a highly complex, specialized organism, which is what we are, then we're going back to being an amoeba colony. And if you remember that study, I think it was very early that I posted on the forum back in 2014, there was this guy who's been studying cancer for, I think, his entire career. He said, we've been thinking of cancer wrongly. It's not an alien species. It's basically what life looked like on Earth 2 billion years ago. So we're basically regressing to what life can be supported with our crappy energy production in a hypothyroid or diseased or poisoned or state or any kind of state that leads to reduced oxygen consumption or driven by the stress hormones.
Got it. You know, I could keep you longer, but it's so late there. I think we should probably cut it off at that, unless you had a burning desire to talk about an article that we did not talk about.
Let's see one more. I mean, like if I... Parkinson's disease. Yes. Progesterone.
Got it.
Very good one. So basically this study kind of told us what Ray has been telling us for many years, that all disease begins in the gut. It's a quote by Hippocrates, I think. It's the original quote.
I think so.
Aristotle believed in it. And basically Ray has been drilling into our heads about the dangers of endotoxin. And how there's now a bunch of different studies showing that Alzheimer's disease has a great connection with periodontal disease, and which has connection with endotoxin. Same thing with Parkinson's disease. But somehow they cannot make the connection that it's really the endotoxin molecule, even the bacteria that translocates and basically causes all of this damage into the brain, ultimately resulting in hypometabolism. So this study says, look, let's admit the obvious. There's an enteric nervous system. It's in constant communication with the central nervous system through the vagus nerve and probably through other mechanisms that we're still yet to find out. And we know that basically everybody with a neurological disease, such as Parkinson's disease, has severe digestive disturbances. So we know that something's going on with the digestive tract. And basically, let's see if we can produce Parkinson's disease by doing something that damages the enteric nervous system cells. And they administer a drug called rotenone, which is perfect example here, because rotenone is a complex 1 inhibitor. So in other words, lowering the metabolic rate of the cells in the enteric nervous system reliably causes Parkinson's disease in mice and in humans. In fact, environmental exposure to rotenone is a known risk factor for Parkinson's disease. So not much there. But the good thing is that we have now official proof and admission, even though it's not widely distributed or broadcasted, is that inhibiting oxidative phosphorylation directly causes Parkinson's disease. Second good finding is that if you expose these cells of the enteric nervous system, co-expose them together with the rotenone, co-expose them to physiological concentrations of progesterone, just I think 10 nanomoles per liter was what they used in the study, it reduced the death of these cells by more than 50%. And that's a puny dose of progesterone, 10 nanomoles. So this means that only a few milligrams even of progesterone taken in the vitamin E specifically, which is also known to heal cells in the enteric nervous system, it can probably be a reliable method for preventing and treating Parkinson's disease, which is exactly what the study found in an animal model of Parkinson's disease. They didn't propose a mechanism of action for progesterone, but we know that progesterone is prometabolic, and since rotenone is anti-metabolic, I think that's really the canceling effect that we're seeing there of progesterone blocking the pro-Parkinson disease, effects of rotenone.
Got it. Crazy, man. I this is somewhat related, but this year seems to be like the year of cascara, you know, like just stimulating bowel movements for people seems to offer great relief.
And so, of everything.
Yeah, yep. And also I've been talking to quite a few people this year that would take a pretty substantial dose of thyroid, but it would not move their bowels. And you'd expect at a certain point of taking 50 micrograms of T3 or something that would stimulate, might cause diarrhea or something. So it's been kind of wild that using both like vitamin D and not both, but vitamin D and thyroid and cascara can really shift a person in the right direction pretty quickly. And,
in my experience, progesterone can cause bowel movement. You take a heavier dosage.
Well, I think that's definitely true. And in fact, if you like take too much progesterone, you might have to like lower your thyroid dose. I've gotten into that a few times of feeling slightly hyper when not necessarily changing the thyroid dose, but changing the progesterone dose.
Yeah, but since rotenone was used here to cause Parkinson's disease and rotenone is a metabolic inhibitor, we know that endotoxin is a metabolic inhibitor. Mm. So this is an indirect proof that endotoxin is a direct cause of Parkinson's disease. So he had more reasons, just like I said, to keep bowel movement regular, because anytime you get backed up, basically, I think a lot of people know this firsthand. You get basically brain fog, right? Yeah. That's the first symptom you're getting. Then you get irritation, agitation, you can't sleep, and so on, depending on how long between going to the bathroom. But you know, I never asked Ray what he considers an optimal thing. Would it be like after every meal, at least once a day?
Meal.
He did, okay.
Yeah. Like I would assume like three times per day at least.
Yeah. The way what was that quote? I think you had on your website, when a Turk's bowels don't move after every meal, the Turk consults a doctor.
Yeah, that was posted on the forum. I thought that was pretty funny. Okay. Hey, thanks, Peggy. Thanks, Philip. They donated to the show. Appreciate you guys. Okay. Let's, closing thoughts, Georgie.
Not much. I think strap up, get your popcorn and, you know, get ready for the show. Either the popcorn will pop or we will, depending on if the nuke flies or not.
What, do you have any big interviews coming up or anything? Anything on the horizon?
I have one with Dr. Mercola this coming Monday.
A lot of people are like, oh, I saw Georgie on Mercola and now I'm talking to you. And so I appreciate both you guys. Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's another doctor who contacted me and, I don't know if we're going to do an interview, but he wants to talk to me on the phone.
Is it Dr. Nitric?
No, not this one. No, I don't think I'll pick up the phone for this guy. Who knows? He may be a pleasant fellow. You know, this guy has a family to feed. What was that quote? A man, like, it's very hard to get a man to understand something if his job depends on not understanding it.
Yeah. By the way, I'd love to have that guy on the show. He can call in and talk to you. That'd be fine.
And what about James Gatz, Danny? He's been hounding you and trying to get on the show for like months.
I wish him the absolute best with all his endeavors. He's a very unique individual and I wish him the absolute best, but I'm part of the Rockefeller apparatus because I was signed to Island Def Jam. That was something he pointed out. So I don't have ground to stand on here. Anyways, so speaking of, I mean, we did talk, like, what was your response to the Grim Hood possible debate? Did you see that at all?
Yeah, I saw it. I mean, like, I don't have a problem with it. I just, you know, if it's going to be just like for shits and giggles and to get people riled up, I'm less inclined to do it.
I don't think that was the vibe of it, but I don't know if he'd want to do it. So, Grim, if you're watching this, we'd like to do a respectful discussion, and I think it would be valuable because he's a thought leader in on Twitter, and obviously people respect Georgie, and I think that'd be fun, but not looking to get nasty or anything. But it would just be a lark. It'd be something fun to do in the end of the world.
If I understand correctly, he's pro magnesium. So there's some overlap with the bioenergetic idea, but some people posted on Twitter that he's like pro serotonin or something.
Yeah, I think are some of the major disagreements. But
I mean, it sounds like it's going to be a good discussion. I'm not looking to get into a fight. I know what I know. He knows what he knows. Hopefully, we can clarify a few discrepancies.
Got it. Hey, Georgie, thank you so much. Really appreciate you staying late, doing the show. Appreciate you so much. 103 episodes. That's crazy. So idealabsdc.com and then idealabsdc.com/lab for the other ones. And absolutely fantastic. Patreon.com/Danny Roddy. And we'll see you guys soon. And thank you so much for watching. Sorry about the lagging. I'm literally mystified. I don't know what's going on. This doesn't make any sense. Okay, guys. See you guys soon. Peace out. Take care. Bye-bye.